Well, we're beginning a whole new series today, a series on the book of Judges. Difficult in some ways, bad time for the Israelites for the most part, but we'll see some glorious interventions of the hand of God. Our text today is Judges chapter 1. I'm going to read it in its entirety. After the death of Joshua, the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, "Who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight them?" The Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand." And Judah said to Simeon, his brother, "Come up with me into the territory allotted to me, that we may fight against the Canaanites. And I likewise will go with you into the territory allotted to you." So Simeon went with him. Then Judah went up, and the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand, and they defeated 10,000 of them at Bezek. They found Adoni Bezek, and fought against him and defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Adoni Bezek fled, but they pursued him, caught him, and cut off his thumbs and big toes. And Adoni Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to pick up scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me." And they brought him to Jerusalem, and he died there. And the men of Judah fought against Jerusalem and captured it, and struck it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. And afterward, the men of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites, who lived in the hill country, in the Negev, and in the lowland. And Judah went against the Canaanites, who lived in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba, and they defeated Shishai and Ahiman and Talmai. From there they went against the inhabitants of Debir. The name of Debir was formerly Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb said, "He who attacks Kiriath Sefer and captures it, I will give him Aksah, my daughter, for a wife." Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, captured it, and he gave him Aksah, his daughter, for a wife. When she came to him, she urged him and asked her father for a field. And she dismounted from her donkey, and Caleb said to her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Give me a blessing. Since you have set me in the land of the Negev, also give me springs of water." And Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. And the descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up with the people of Judah from the city of the palms into the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the Negev and near Arad. And they went and settled with the people. And Judah went with Simeon his brother, and they defeated the Canaanites who inhabited Zephath and devoted it to destruction. So the name of the city was called Hormah. Judah also captured Gaza with its territory, and Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. And the Lord was with Judah, and he took possession of the hill country, but he could not drive out the inhabitants of the plain because they had iron chariots. And Hebron was given to Caleb, as Moses had said, and he drove out from it three sons of Anak. But the people of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem. So the Jebusites have lived with the people of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. The house of Joseph also went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with them. And the house of Joseph scouted out Bethel. Now the name of the city was formerly Luz. But the spies saw a man coming out of the city, and they said to him, "Please show us a way into the city, and we'll deal kindly with you." And he showed them a way into the city, and they struck the city with the edge of the sword, but they let the man and all his family go. And the man went to the land of the Hittites and built a city, called its name Luz, and that is its name to this day. Well, the book of Judges is a historical narrative, even as you can tell here just in the first chapter. The author or the editor is really unknown. Some think maybe Samuel, some think maybe David, but the date isn't certain either of when it was put together. Most likely it was written or compiled by a single author or editor during the time of David, but not necessarily written by David. It records the events that transpired from the death of Joshua through to the ministry of Samuel. Now, the work of eradicating the Canaanites from the land was not yet complete. Joshua had won many victories, but there was still more to be done. The repeated scenario in the book is this: sin and rebellion, followed by oppression, followed by crying out to God, followed by deliverance. And then it happens all over again and again and again. Some of the judges are quite popular today, Gideon and Samson. You can find them in Sunday school material and Bible storybooks all over the place. But there are others that are almost unheard of. We'll take a look at all of them. Now, there was an overlap of one judge with another at times. So the chronology of the book is anything but simple. Remember, too, that some of the judges were quite local, delivering perhaps one area or one tribe, not dealing with the whole nation. A bit of a theme verse, and you probably know this, a theme verse might be Judges 17:6. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. In other words, chaos, anarchy, not good. Well, we find in verses 1 and 2, Yahweh, the Lord, gives them some counsel. After the death of Joshua, the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, who said, "Who shall go up first?" And he tells them, "Judah shall go up first. I've given the land into his hand." They remained faithful even after Joshua's death, at least for a while. And they knew enough to inquire of the Lord about how to proceed. I find it a bit amazing, given how often they messed up, how often they were rebellious during the time in the wilderness, and that sort of thing. They didn't despair after Joshua died, but rather they turned to the Lord for guidance and wisdom. Now, what we know of their history, we're tempted to say, wow. So they asked who should attack first. It was the tribe of Judah, appointed by God himself. Now, we're told in Numbers 2 that Judah was to lead the way into the wilderness also. Judah was designated at the time that Jacob blessed his sons as the kingly tribe. So it was fitting that this tribe would go up first into battle. Now the Lord assures them of victory. "I've given the land into his hand," he says. This is similar to what the Lord assured Joshua when he set out after Moses died. We read in Joshua 1, "After the death of Moses, servant of the Lord said to Joshua, son of Nun, 'Moses' aide, 'Moses, my servant, is dead. Now then, you and all these people get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land I'm about to give to them, to the Israelites. I will give to you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses.'" Kind of builds confidence, doesn't it? But think of how much doubt hinders us. You're thinking of trying something new. I'm going to do this new thing. But then you start thinking, what if it doesn't work out? And you don't do it. Doubt is a crippler. But what if you had this kind of assurance from the Lord? "I've given the land into his hand." Would that make a difference to you? 40 years before, the report came back from the spies that went into the land that the sons of Anak were in the land. The spies said they felt like grasshoppers before them. These were giants, powerful military giants. Do you still want to attack? Or might doubt come creeping in, destroying your confidence? Well, it did for those 10 spies. Remember that story. Only Caleb and Joshua knew that the Lord could deliver the Canaanites into their hand, even those sons of Anak that were there. And here we have a promise to that same end. "I've given them into his hand." Well, Judah had significant success. Judah obeys, and the tribe of Simeon to join them. And Simeon's allotment of the land was actually embedded within the land given to Judah. So it makes sense that they would fight together, and then Judah would reciprocate when it came time for Simeon to attack their enemies. Now, originally, the original Judah and Simeon, tribes named after two men, but those two men were actually full brothers. They were both sons of Jacob and Leah. So you have all this confusion of the brothers of Jacob, but these two were genuine brothers. But then we read, then Judah went up, and the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand. They defeated 10,000 of them at Bezek. Now, Bezek was in the mountains northwest of, but not that far from Jerusalem. But the success of Judah was not essentially Judah doing it, or even his wisdom to ask Simeon to join him. No, rather, the Lord gave them into his hand. Yahweh brought the victory. Reminds me of one of the verses we studied not too long ago from 1 John 5. For everyone who has been born of God overcomes the world, and this is the victory that has overcome the world, even our faith. The leader of the enemy forces was this guy, Adonai Bezek. Adonai means Lord, so essentially his name is Lord of Bezek. 6 tells us what happened to him. He tried to flee, but they pursued him, caught him, cut off his big toes and his thumbs. And his confession is interesting, isn't it? 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to pick up scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has done to me. Now, we would confess and believe that we do indeed reap what we sow. God brings temporal consequences into our lives. But this thumb and toe thing is quite incapacitating. You wouldn't think that's big of a deal, but yeah, you can barely walk or run. You couldn't hold a weapon anymore. Here was a warrior king, and he's reduced to nothing. His days are done as a leader. So he was taken to Jerusalem, and we're told he died there, but we're not told how. I mean, you can live in that condition, but you might be crawling around under some other guy's table picking up scraps. We're not told how long he lived there, but he lived in that condition. Now, when the text says 70 kings, don't get into mind kings of huge nations or empires. These essentially were mayors of cities, but they were recognized as kings with much of the pomp and circumstance of a king, but they were, you know, two-bit head honcho of this little bitty town. After Bezek is taken, they move on to Jerusalem. The capture of Jerusalem is difficult to understand. Herbert Wolf, in his commentary, says this: the city of Jerusalem did not become an integral part of Israel until David and Joab stormed the forces of the Jebusites in 2 Samuel 5. So it's a good bit time later. Hence, the successful attack of Judah was either temporary or partial in its capture. Jerusalem had, you know, the outer city and then the inner citadel, the real solid fortress. So the inner citadel represents the final line of defense. The men of Judah probably failed to penetrate the Jebusite fortress itself. The problem is complicated by the reference in verse 21 to the Benjamites' failure to drive out the Jebusites out of Jerusalem. Joshua 15:63 is almost identical to verse 21, except for the substitution of Judah for Benjamin. The solution lies in the location of Jerusalem, directly on the border between Benjamin and Judah. It properly belonged to the territory of Benjamin, but both tribes had significant interest in the city. Now, there was much more to conquer and settle. As I had said before, Joshua had had significant successes. But there's all this entire area that needed to be subdued and the tribes driven out according to God's command. Wolf again. From Jerusalem, the men of Judah went south and west to continue their conquest. The three areas mentioned are the major geographical divisions of southern Palestine. The hill country are the central mountain region extending south to Hebron and Iran. The Negev is the dry ground, the southern sections, basically a desert, and the western foothills. I've heard it different two ways, Shephelah or Shephelah, not sure which way to say it. That represents the region between the mountains and the coastal plain, usually a fairly fertile area. Well, they turned toward Hebron. And Judah went against the Canaanites who lived in Hebron. Now, the name of Hebron used to be Kiriath Arba, and they defeated Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai there. And when I went to Israel years ago, we were unable to visit Hebron. It was too politically unstable, too dangerous a place to go. It was very, very disappointing. I really wanted to go there because it was one of the homes of Abraham. It's where he bought property and the cave of Machpelah in order to bury Sarah. It's where the Lord appeared to Abraham before he went down to destroy Sodom, a very significant city in Israel's history. And it will become again in during the reign of David. Well, the Lord continued to give victory. An interesting story about the capture of Debir. They went against Debir, but Caleb stands up and says, "Hey, anybody who captures this place, I'll give my daughter to be his wife." So he sets it up as a bride price for anybody who wants to go conquer it. But we're told elsewhere that the sons of Anak also lived there, so there were still giants in the land. It's difficult because of the relationships involved. Lawson Younger said this, "Thus, Othniel, who was the guy who captured the city, is designated the son of Kenaz, and hence a Kenazite. He is further designated as Caleb's younger brother, which probably means that Othniel was a younger relative or kinsman of Caleb." The Hebrew word ab has that range of meaning, doesn't necessarily mean brother. That explains why Caleb is called the son of Jephunneh, and Othniel is called the son of Kenaz. Yet Othniel is called Caleb's brother, and Caleb calls a Kenazite. So it's pretty confusing, but I think we do escape the issue of Othniel marrying his niece, which was a forbidden relationship. You weren't allowed to do that. So there may not have been any significant blood relations at all. We can't be sure. And we'll see in chapter 3 when we get there that Othniel became a judge and had great victories himself. But it goes on. Judah also captured Gaza with its territory, Ashkelon, Ekron. The Lord was with Judah. He took possession of the hill country, but could not drive out the inhabitants of the plain because they had chariots of iron. Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron were Philistine cities. The attack route of the Jews sounds like it was from south to north because the cities are in that order. This would have happened somewhere around 1375 BC. So a couple hundred years before the major migration of the Philistines into the land. So the capture must have been temporary to some degree. Later on, like in David's time, the Philistine cities were Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Gath, and Ekron. What do we know about Gath? It's where Goliath came from. And they were an ongoing problem for Israel. And not until like 604 BC, the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar II destroyed the Philistine cities of Ashkelon, Gaza, Aphek, and Ekron. And the inhabitants were either killed or exiled to Mesopotamia. Fascinating, isn't it, that there's still conflict in Gaza between Palestinians, whose name is derived from Philistine, and the people of Israel. But then we get a short note in verse 21 that the Benjamites were not able to rid Jerusalem of the Jebusites, so they lived there together. Is that what God had commanded? No, drive them out, he said. Now, the failure in the north is pretty epic. The story of the north is quite different than what was going on in the south with Judah. The defeat of Bethel was an exception. This is recorded in verses 22 to 26. The sons of Joseph would be the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh. They take Bethel. Bethel is the place where Jacob had his dream of the ladder to heaven, and God spoke to him there. It was formerly named Luz, but Jacob renamed it Bethel, the house of God. Then we read of Manasseh. What do we see right off the bat? Verse 27, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth-shean, or the inhabitants, these various other towns and cities that are listed there. So the Canaanites persisted in dwelling in the land. What a difference from the first part of the chapter. They were commanded to drive all of them out. Now, we're not given the details of what they were thinking and saying to themselves or to one another, but I'm sure it's similar to kinds of things that we would be saying today. I'm tired of all this warfare. Let's just settle down and be at peace. There's too many of them. We'll never be able to get them all out. Now, we're not told, but maybe some of the Anakim, the giants, were still there, and they were simply afraid to attack. I wonder if there were some who thought that this whole idea of dispossessing a people was wrong and therefore didn't want any part of that whole plan. Nah, that's way too modern an idea. That wouldn't have been happening then. But any of that is actually possible. But the main reason was lack of trust in God. He told them what to do. He promised that if they trusted him and obeyed him, he would deliver them into their hands. So lack of faith in God brought them out of Egypt. But that was the problem, that they didn't continue to trust him for this land. So they settled for less than what God had commanded. Look at verse 28. When Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not drive them out completely. Similar kind of story continues. In verse 29, Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer. The Canaanites lived among them. Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants of Kittan or the inhabitants of Nahalol, or the Canaanites lived among them but became subject to forced labor. Asher didn't drive out the inhabitants. It goes on and on. Failure after failure to do what God had commanded. Ralph Davis in his commentary said this, "The motivation for driving out the Canaanites was not pragmatic, but spiritual. Yahweh had warned through Moses, do not let those people live in your country. If you do, they will make you sin against me. If you worship their gods, it will be a fatal trap for you." Remaining Canaanites would not be so much a military threat as a spiritual cancer. We know the history. The same thing in the next section. Naphtali did not drive them out. But it gets worse. Look at verse 34. The Amorites pressed the people of Dan back into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the plain. So this portion of the nation is already being oppressed. They were being oppressed by those that they were supposed to have driven out. What a sad situation. Rather than victory and delight and joy, the Danites are hindered and confined. Ralph Davis gives this powerful summary of this whole situation. He writes, "Though our writer repeatedly accuses Israel of covenant failure, she did not dispossess. He nevertheless describes her military success. This point is frequently missed. Four times he tells us that the Canaanites or Amorites became subject to forced labor. What does this mean? It means that if once Israel's tribes were not strong enough to expel the local residents, the time came when Israel grew strong and could dominate the Canaanite population. But instead of expelling, instead of driving out these enclaves, which according to the biblical text, Israel was now perfectly able to do, she put them to forced labor in violation of Yahweh's command." The picture Judges 1 gives us is of an Israel in substantial control of Canaan, but a people clearly successful, though certainly disobedient. Pragmatic success and spiritual failure. A strange but possible combination. So Israel's dominant, if not obedient. She enjoys a superiority even if she does not maintain fidelity. What a sad indictment. And what a warning to us. Let's repent of our halfway obedience, the pragmatic success but spiritual failure. Sounds very much like the contemporary American church. What should they have done? They should have repented, turned to Yahweh, and trusted him to do what he said, to drive them all out. They could have driven them out because the Lord would fight for them, but they didn't. They chose not to. whatever the reasons may have been, just might have been the easier way out. So we too need to turn from ourselves, from our puny schemes, from our contentment being at ease in Zion, as the prophet says, and turn to Christ, our Savior. We need to trust Him because He has already paid for our sin. He's taken up residence in us. His redeeming work for us is full and complete and worthy of our trust. And we can grow in faithfulness to Christ, and we should. He's willing. Are you, is the question. So fill your mind with Christ and His loving and saving work for you. Ask Him to help you to be more trusting, to strengthen your faith in Him, to drive out the Canaanites, to be diligent. And so rest in the complete salvation that Christ has accomplished for you. Rest in Christ, but don't bail in the battle, and don't compromise with those who want you to do evil. Let's come to His table.